So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff, stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
So another bass player. Oh my God, how many is this?
It's not like we haven't had any guitarists.
Yes, but in the real world, there should be more guitarists generally than bass players. Is that true, isn't it?
No, it's true that there are. It's not necessarily true that there should be.
Well, because there could be two guitarists for every one bass player.
Yeah, there could be two bass players for every one guitarist, if you think about it.
What band is that? I'm never going to see them play.
Peter Hook. What's funny, actually, I saw Peter Hook with his solo band. And what's funny was that he had another bass player. So he's playing all his stuff, so there's this bass player who's playing all of Hookie's lines, which are all right up the dusty end anyway, and then which frees Hookie up to go even further up the dusty end. So you've got two bass players and still no bass happening at all.
Call for Guy Pratt. Well, we've got another bass player coming on now, haven't we? So this is our moment.
Yes, we have. A true trailblazing original.
But not just a bass player, like Paul McCartney, a bass player songwriter.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I don't think he quite gets the credit for that.
No.
You know, it's for certainly an epoch-making catalogue, shall we say.
Let's dig deep and find out. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Right, you there?
Yay!
Hey! sorry, I had a last tinkle. Am I there?
How you doing, Glenn?
I'm doing all right, but we've only just started. Nice Rickenbacker there. There you go.
Yeah, I thought that actually did just happen to be there, but I sort of thought you'd probably like that.
You don't see many sunburst ones.
No, this is it's actually called Montezuma, this, and it's a colour they only did in 2003.
I can only apologise.
I don't know what to say about it. I mean, the thing, I'm going to play the white man between you two. You're a guitarist. Guy's a bass player. Yeah. Look, this is my crust.
What is that? That's Montezuma's Revenge.
No, can you see it?
That's beautiful. A Hofner.
It's a Hofner President, and it's exactly what Tommy Steele played.
Oh, there you go.
Well, the old time cave. Well, I lived in a cave. I'll leave it at that.
Because in fact, actually, Glenn, for those who don't know, which is probably all of you, my dad, Mike Pratt, co-wrote with Lionel Bart all of Tommy Steele's old songs. And the only time I've ever performed one of them was with you, Glenn, I think, at a party of David Gilmour's in about 1988. The Caveman.
And which was one of the most well-equipped gigs that I've ever done. I was sitting in with the Pretty Things, my one own. Actually, I did another gig with them, but they were mates of mine. They were short of a bass player. I did it. Where we're playing, Dave Gilmour's house, get there. And it wasn't just a marquee on the tennis court, it was a marquee on the tennis courts. with an S on the end. And I thought, oh, how do you ever off live, right?
lots of pedals, effects, I can imagine, yeah.
Well, all the people that were there, it was like Eric Idle was there and all that lot. George Harrison was there. And he was going to get up and play with us, and then he realised he was too pissed.
That's right. That's
and
right.
I was gutted. I thought I was going to play with...
I got berated by Rabbit Bundrick.
Who's Rabbit guy?
Who was the Who's keyboard player, who's this big, brawly Texan, who just came... Yeah, I just got up because you asked me to, did Rock with the Caveman, and then he just came over to me and went, you're awful! You're terrible!
Well, he was probably right.
Yeah, he probably was. I mean, I was pretty pissed.
Rocking the Caveman was actually officially the first rock and roll record ever made by an Englishman, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1956.
Ronnie Scott played the sax solo.
Ronnie Scott played the sax solo. I don't know. It's probably somebody like Brian Bennett or Clem Clutini on drums.
Yeah.
Your dad didn't write that song, though, did he, Guy?
Yeah.
He wrote Rocky the Caveman.
Yeah.
And actually, I think I pointed it out to Guy that night.
I was aware of that. No, but I love that you were, but you did that for a while, Glenn. You were a great champion.
That's my party piece.
That. And I do a party band. I love that. It made me very proud.
Also, a few years back, I went to a Nordoff Robbins thing at some swanky hotel down the Park Lane, and Tim Rice was getting an award, and he was at the next table, and all the way through, and you could have whoever you wanted to sort of nominate and give you the speech for you, and he had Tommy Steele. And Tommy Steele was at the next table with his back to me, and I was dying to go to speak to him, but I thought I won't interrupt his dinner and all that. And Tim Rice was on last, and then Tommy Steele went up to give his speech. He left he had like a couple of carrier bags by his back, by his seat, went up on stage, and I thought, well, when he comes back, I'll say hello to him. Do you know what? That was the last thing on. He went off backstage with Tim Rice and everybody else. I'm sitting there waiting for him to come. He never came back. I got slung out and he's two bags with it. And I thought, what do I do? Do I take his Tesco's bag? Oh, Mr. Steele, I've got your cockles in here.
What was in the bag?
I don't know. I didn't dare look. You know, it could be anything.
Why not? No, come on. That was...
it could have been the other half of the sixpence.
Oh, God. What year is the Hofner?
I think it's about 60, 61, actually, but it's the same style. It's not Tommy Steele's one, obviously. They don't have Tommy Steele's guitar up the Kilburn High Road underneath the railway bridge where they sell sort of cheap double basses for the people who go to the music college up there. I don't think Tommy Steele's guitar would be there somehow.
Although that did sound like a line from a Tommy Steele song. Kilburn High Road, under.
That's got to be in Ian Dury territory now. But
I think we've mentioned Tommy before, but, you know, people who don't know don't realise that he, you know, how important he is in the history of rock music and, you know, playing down at the Two Eyes and bringing over those records from America, that because he was a sailor, wasn't he, buying all those...
Yeah, he was a merchant seaman. Yeah.
But what's extraordinary is, because the history of music, rock music, it's really hard to gauge the time of it all, because you the Sex Pistols were actually less than 20 years after that.
And that was 40 odd years ago now. It's kind of funny, though.
It's 80 years ago. Oh yeah. Sorry.
We need a mathematician around it.
Yeah, it's a strong point.
Yeah. No, but also when you're a kid, when you're growing up, I got a theory where you kind of get waves of music. Lots of people listen to music when they're growing up and they're too young to do anything about it. And maybe they might hear their brothers who are a bit older than them or something going on in their neighbourhood. And then when they finally pick up a guitar and then maybe a few years later learn something to do about it, they tend to go back to the music that they first heard. So think about Green Day, right? Punk band, sort of 10 years after, which is the gestation period of punk music coming out. All the two-tone stuff, 10 years after the original kind of blue beat thing going on in the 60s. Yeah, yeah. And for me, it was my contribution to punk, but it was kind of 10 years after the swinging 60s and all those fantastic, you know, Tamla and Ready Steady Go and the early Kinks and the Yardbirds and the Who. That's kind of what got me going. But also, in the back of my mind, there was stuff before that. And, you know, when I was a kid, there was old cars around, like Joe Javelins. You seen one of them for years? Vauxhall Vanguard or Austin Somerset.
The
and Tommy's, yeah.
In Tommy's, it was a Labour.
Even before that. And it, Tommy still fits in with all that kind of stuff. You know, it's that stuff that was just before your time that you was aware of, but you didn't really know too much about.
Well, it's true that, you know, when in the early 70s, you know, there was that mid-70s, there was that 50s rock and roll, rockabilly kind of revival, wasn't there? Which is Malcolm and Vivian kind of latched onto.
Yeah, and who else?
Yeah, there was a big rock and roll revival, wasn't there, at that time? There was that big, they used to have shows at Wembley Stadium.
You know, when you first started with the Pistols, one of the songs you were doing was No Lip, wasn't it? Which is Dave Berry.
Yeah.
It was quite an obscure B-side. That was from the 60s, I guess. You know, that,
yeah, it's about that, 64, 65.
Who decided that was a song that you guys should do in the band?
It was a bit of a collective consciousness. Lots of those songs came from the jukebox that Malcolm had, and we found the B-sides a bit more interesting and doable than the A-sides. I mean, it's the B-side of a Crying Game. You can't imagine Johnny Rotten singing The Crying Game, but you could do Don't Give Me No Lip, Child, which we changed around a bit. And we liked all that kind of stuff. I mean, through doing that, I actually got... it's so funny. I went to some dude. In the early 80s, there was a club called Legends down the bottom of Savile Row.
I think we've all ended up on Legends.
and I'd actually done the cover of a song called This Strange Effect, which is another Dave Berry song, right? And Dave Berry was playing. And he had a band, but it was like a real Batley Variety Club kind of band. And they did a number and it'd take it down to some kind of 70s, you know, boogie kind of thing while he introduced the song. And he said, okay, right, I'm now going to do a song which is a big hit for me, big hit for me. And it was also a big alternative hit for a great friend of mine from the Sex Pistols, Glenn Matlock. I thought, well, I'm quite surprised he's even heard me because I put it out as a little single. So he's signing things after the gig. So I go up to him and I'm like, hello, Dave, how are you going? Who are you? I said, I'm your great friend. it was great. It was great meeting him. He started sending me a Christmas card every year for about 10 years. Sat on Caulfield.
We're going to go back a bit further. I just got to hook onto that jukebox that's in Malcolm's and Vivian's shop. Vivian Westwood's shop.
Because we were literally just talking about that before. Well, because...
It was your story, didn't you?
It was my story. And no, because apparently, because Johnny Rotten's audition was singing I'm 18, wasn't it? The Alice Cooper song from the jukebox.
In front of the jukebox, yeah. But he didn't really sing along very well, but it was something about the way... It was a kind of a weird scenario. He was there with his mate and there was us that we'd never met before and we'd all been to the pub and he came back and he was... He must have felt very awkward and he just sort of gooned around a bit in quite an interesting way.
Because you'd all just been drawn to this shop, right?
We all independently made our way there. I got a job there because I was looking for a job and I got one because I dug it. And there was something about the place and all these people started coming and Stephen Paul would come in trying to nick things. It was my job to stop them. But you laugh, they did, you know.
No, I know that. And I mean, Steve was legendary. He once, the first flat I ever lived in, he came round to visit and someone said, someone's bringing Steve Jones around, put your guitar under the bed.
Right, yeah, but that's the first place he'd look. Yeah, that's true. But anyway, the people all came from different things and we all met there, so...
No, but I'm interested in that whole Kings Road scene as well. I think we'll dig that out of you in a bit. But where did you grow up?
Kensal Green, up the Arrow Road. So not far from the top of Ladbroke Grove on the Arrow Road. Go up at Ladbroke Grove, over the canal bridge, turn left, and there's a cemetery on your left. And I lived at the other end of the cemetery. But what was good about it, it was the school I went to, it was half West Indian and half white kids. And it's like in the early 60s, lots of the kids were into music. In the summer, everybody'd have their windows open and there'd be all Bluebeat and ska pumping out.
But what kind of music were you into though at that time as a kid? I mean, what turned you on? What's the first thing that really went, that's it, that's under my skin?
All right, well, my uncle was about 10 years older than me and wasn't really a teddy boy, but had sort of flirted with that. And he gave me his old 78s when he then wanted to look like Anthony Newley and go in his slade with a white... He did, you know.
Right. And
the white Mac and all the slim Jim tie and drainpipe trousers or one of the Cray twins kind of thing. You know all about that, right? That kind of look. And he gave me his old 78. So the first records I actually put on were Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis, not Jerry Lewis.
Well, hey! Maybe The Big Bopper. There was a record I liked, Chantilly Lace, but B-side... Yeah. The B-side was Purple People, He's a Meat Switch Doctor, and it's all got sped-up vocals like Pinky and Perky kind of thing. So as a kid, I liked that. But then that coincided with only two pop programmes on the radio. This is before your time, Gary, only just. But there was there was Jimmy Savile, whose name we shouldn't really mention, played the Top 40 on a Sunday. But I always thought as a kid, well, how do you know what a Top 40 is if you can't hear any records? You know, to chew, that's a fair enough point. And there was a show on Saturday mornings called the Brian Matthews Show, and he used to play comedy clips from like Hancock's Half Hour interspersed with songs, you know, like the Dave Clark Five and maybe the Beatles and stuff like that. And that's when I first started hearing it. And then that coincided with transistor radios coming out. So we all started listening when you went to bed at night with the transistor radio under your pillow, Radio Luxembourg, and then Radio London and... Caroline stuff started off, you know, that movie that came out, The Boat That Rocked, which is a comedy about it, but that was the size of it. But that coincided with all the early bands coming through, you know, like the Kinks and the Who and the Yardbirds and the Stones and the Idle Race and the Small Faces. And then we had the most fantastic pop show ever in the whole world, was Ready, Steady, Go, and all those bands would play live. That's what really got me going. You know, it's that 3-minute epic song, which is hopefully of... got some lyrics or some kind of consequence. You know, it's not just la 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 love songs. And
Ray Davis, I think, or Stevie Marriott would have written those kind of lyrics. So.
Yeah, but also with that, I had Dusty Springfield on the show, and she used to co-host it sometimes.
And tons of soul, didn't they?
She brought it into the show. Yeah. She was hip to Stax and Tamla Motown. So as well as that, you'd have Sam and Dave, you'd have Junior Walker on, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. Singing like it was fantastic.
But you're still You're very young then, aren't you, Glenn?
I was about 10, but maybe I had an aptitude for it. It was the best. It was better than Car 54, Where Are You?
And how did you end up with a guitar in your hand?
Because I wanted one, and I asked for one for Christmas, and I got probably the cheapest one on the knot from a place in Alston, which actually somehow has ended up in the vault, in the Hard Rock, in their kind of little museum thing in Piccadilly. I don't know how I ended up there. I flogged it to somebody a long time ago. And I went down there, and it was there. And I'd taken my kids... Well, I'd heard it was there, and I went down and I took my kids down when they were younger. And it's fantastic. It's actually in an old bank vault. In the room, they've got Jimmy Page's Les Paul. They've got a Flying V that belonged to Jimi Hendrix. They've got Entwistle's bass. They've got Les Paul's number two Les Paul.
Wow.
All arranged around this safe that looks like... the door's been blown off, and it's the acoustic guitar that my mum and dad bought me, and I couldn't play it at the time. So what I did, I kept trying to tart it up a bit, and once my dad worked at Rolls-Royce at the time, and he got a load of burl walnut veneer that I covered the top of it with, but I made such a bad job, I had to shave it all off, and then it looked a bit plain. So around the sound hole, you know, you have all that nice abalone and, you know, design. Nah. Felt tip pen, free end. It's dreadful. But the girl who's working there said all the kids come in, they relate to that guitar more than any other one because it's the kind of thing they might end up kind of getting.
So did you write Pistol songs on that?
A little bit, yeah.
We'll say that.
I did a little bit, but do you know what? It was a plank, and it still is. And I got it out for me, and I went blah, and he went, oh, man, dreadful.
Cheese colour. But you went to St Martin's School of Art, didn't you? Did you do fashion there or art?
I did a foundation course where you do a little bit of everything. And then I got in to do a degree in fine art painting. I could have been the first Damien Hirst, not the second one. But in the summer holidays, I decided to take the pistol seriously. So I went in on the first day of the new term, booked the pistols to play there. And... then went to the bursar's office and said, like, I'm not coming, give my place to somebody else. And I kind of thought they was going to say, oh, Glenn, we need you. And I went, oh, all right then. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do now? So I had to concentrate on the band, you know.
And when did the bass come into it?
Well, that's how I got the gig in the band, because Stephen Ball came in and I had a fledgling band. And they was, for some reason, I was always trying to get Malcolm involved, and he kind of humoured them.
The Strand, wasn't it? The Strand, their band was called, wasn't it?
The Strand at one stage, then the Swankers. This is a long time before John was in the band. There was another guy in the band called Wally. He was quite good, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Wally Nightingale, Warwick Nightingale. We called him Wally, and he was a bit of a Ron Wood kind of type. But anyway, they came in one Saturday afternoon. I'm making sure they don't nick anything. Malcolm's talking to him, and he said, "How's it going with the band, lads?" And Paul said, "Well, I don't know, Malcolm. We're trying to take it seriously, but the bass player never turns up." And I said, "I had a bass for about 2 months." And I said, "I play bass." And they went, "Do you?" And I said, "Yeah." And the first question was, "What's your favourite band?" And I said, "The Faces." And they went, "That's our favourite band." And that's what got me the gig.
But so you say you had a bass for about 2 months. So why had you got the bass before you just decided?
Somebody at school. This is still when I was at school, because I worked there Saturdays for my beer money. And somebody at school was flogging them. So I thought I'd have a go at it. But as you know, Guy, you buy a bass guitar, you got no amp, you got nobody else to play with.
Tell me about it.
You know, it's kind of what you do. You know, the only way you can hear the bass if you ain't got an amp is jam it against a wardrobe or something like that as some big soundboard. So you soon realise you need to play with other people. So there was a perfect opportunity.
You know, how come you're ending up working in what was one of the hippest shops in King's Road? Describe King's Road and what that was, and these key shops that were down there that ended up creating the whole punk scene.
Back then, there wasn't all the shops that ended up creating the punk scene. It was the tail end of the hippie and swinging London. You know, there was like Antiquarius, there was Great Gear Market, there was Alcasura.
As Granny Takes a Trip was gone by then, right?
No, that was still there. When I was looking for this shop I'd heard of, I got off the number 11 bus, and there was a shop with... I'd never been down the King's Road before, and there was a car with half a car sticking out of a window, and I thought, this might be it. And I went in there, and they were like dressed like the Rolling Stones. I thought, well, this ain't it, because I was looking for a pair of brothel creepers.
That was that Paradise Garage when it had with the car?
No, that was Granny Tuck's Trip. And Let It Rock, which was Malcolm's shop. Yeah. That was what was Paradise Garage before, right. And he got it for Tommy Roberts. But they were the only two shops, and they were totally the wrong end of the King's Road. You know, most people would go to the tube station at Sloane Square, and you'd have to walk all the way along the King's Road to find the interesting bits if you wanted something different. But a few people did want something different. Yeah, but what kind of was good for us as a band, we all used to drink in a Roebuck, which not there anymore, became the Dome. But there'd be all these people who are like characters out of Budgie in there. You know, and you talk to some bloke who's a bit older and all that. You go, "What do you do, mate?" He goes, "Well, I'm a diamond dealer, aren't I?" You know, you know, and then a bit of the guys from Granny's coming in, and Nick Kent was hanging out there, and you'd see Anthony Price and Brian Ferry sort of strolling up and down the road. It was all that kind of thing. Malcolm all thought they were tossers, so we did too.
But that's an incredible sort of mixture, isn't it? A boiling pot of, you know, working class flash and artsy middle class fashion students and teachers.
Yeah, and that's also London at its finest, I think.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
You know, and that was why I enjoyed going to art college. It was all working class blokes who were having to go do something, and all the girls were debutantes.
But just thinking, Guy, what the kind of music that was sort of happening, you know, because punk came along. Also, I wouldn't mind knowing when you first heard that word, that term punk, but, you know, punk came along and it sort of wiped the slate clean for everybody. You know, we were, there was the whole sort of obviously Eric Clapton, Pink Floyd and Genesis and the prog rock thing going on as well, sort of American cowboy prog rock stuff. But then punk was really much more connected with glam rock, wasn't it? In you know, you could see a connection with Roxy Music and with Bowie and obviously what was going on in America with New York Dolls and Iggy.
Well, that, you know, and yes, glam rock had kind of been and gone. And if it had gone anywhere, it had gone to America to try and break the American market. So those bands weren't really around. I saw the Spiders from Mars at Earl's Court, you know, saw the Faces at Wembley, and had no idea who was on. But wanted to get me money's worth, because back in those days I had to buy a ticket. There was this first band on with the Pink Fairies, whose time had kind of been and gone without actually arriving in the middle. And there was this other band that I'd heard about, because Malcolm and Tommy Roberts had been going on about seeing them at Bieber, which I was a bit too young to go to. Sport band, New York Dolls, the original New York Dolls with Billy Mercer on the drums. about a week before he OD'd.
Yeah, because that was it. Because Malcolm had went to New York and tried to salvage them, didn't he? He'd managed them. I wonder if, but they weren't really part of the New York punk scene, were they?
No, but you know, and don't forget, it's everything us getting together took a couple of 18 months or years, and time goes really quickly. Then the Mountain was going backwards and forwards to the States, and he tried to get them back together, and he did that red patent leather look thing with them, which and then they broke up and they filmed the Heartbreakers.
Oh, also, I'm really sorry to interject. I'm sorry. I would like to point out the first proper gig I ever had was playing for Sylvain.
Oh, well, there you go. Where was that?
I never knew that.
It was when he moved to London. And I went to Paris and Stockholm with him. And stuff,
right.
So.
Oh, okay, cool.
But carry on. Sorry.
Why didn't he? I want to know why he didn't ask me.
That's a very good question. I was probably cheaper. I mean, I was literally, you know.
Oh, whatever is that?
Yeah, Sylvain was going to be, wasn't he going to be the lead singer of the Sex Pistols for a bit?
He was going to come over and try out, but it didn't really work. And another guy we had some kind of contact with, and I think the letter was Richard Hell, you know, from the Voidoids, who Malcolm had met over there. But all these people, well, maybe the Dolls had, but not Richard L or the Ramones we'd heard about. Nobody had made records at that stage, so we never heard them.
So was it you and Steve and Paul in a little rehearsal room without a singer for a bit?
For a bit, but originally Steve was the singer, and it was me, Steve, Wally. Now, me, Paul, Steve and Wally. Wally playing the guitar and Steve singing and having a go at playing a guitar. Steve thought he was like Steve Ellis or somebody like that, mixed with Tom Jones. It wasn't quite right.
And were you writing songs by this point, Glenn? Was it?
Having a go, but I think a lot of people in bands will probably agree with me this. You think, let's do a cover. So you have a go at doing a cover, and do you know what? Sometimes it's a bit too hard. You know, all those chord things. So you don't do the complicated bits, you do a simpler version. And then soon, it sounds so unlike what you're trying to play, but actually sounds quite good. You got your own song. I think that's how most people start writing.
Exactly right. Yeah. You steal at first, don't you? I mean, I remember the first song I ever wrote was basically, I have a hammer. If I had a hammer.
Trini Lopez.
So someone showed me this book I had, the chords of If I Had a Hammer, and I played those four chords, and I thought, I like the chords, but I really hate the tune. I'm going to write my own tune on that. So you kind of borrow, don't you? But what the songs you cover are often revealing to your influences, obviously. One of the songs you did when I saw the Pistols play was I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. Which is the Monkees. How did that end up in your world?
I think possibly that was Paul's idea to do that one. Possibly because he liked the sort of Tamla drum beat, you know, bah, bah, bah. I don't know, but it kind of fitted in somehow, and it was quite easy to do. But we probably, even though the Monkees did it, I won't put money on this, but maybe Malcolm had Paul Revere and the Raiders version of it on the jukebox, maybe. And then the Monkees did it. Oh, well, no matter, we'll do a better version than them. But, you know, one of the other things that was going on in the mid to late 60s was the Monkees. You know, their show was fun. It was great. There was nothing wrong with the Monkees. They were a laugh, you know.
Yeah, great songwriters,
you know, Neil Diamond and all that lot.
This is Guy's connection with Pink Floyd. I hate Pink Floyd. I saw that at the Pink Floyd show, Guy, that T-shirt.
Yeah, no, I saw it. But interestingly enough, because John was actually a big Pink Floyd fan, wasn't he? And apparently the rumour is that Sid was called Sid after Sid Barrett. And because someone pointed this out in an interview years later, because remember back in the mid-70s, T-shirts were a big, big deal, right? You took it seriously. You had to send off somewhere in the back of the NME, some address in Newcastle, and you waited 3 weeks for your T-shirt. Yeah. And so when some journalist finally said to John, but you did have a Pink Floyd T-shirt. And he said, yeah, I'm amazed it took you so long. Of course, I love Pink Floyd.
All right, well, there you go. But I think
there was always that T-shirt, wasn't there, of that big fat bloke saying sod off to some little guy.
Flying United, making bacon. Making bacon.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
But is it true that John wrote "I hate" over the top of that t-shirt, and that's why someone spotted him and thought he's going to be perfect?
I don't know if it was because of the t-shirt, but I do know he wrote on it. But I think he probably wrote on it on joining a punk band that maybe it wasn't the coolest thing, so it was some kind of smokescreen. You know, but
it was Cookie who wore on Top of the Pops, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look at the Who. How many pictures of the Who are there? Well, one of them's got the Union Jack jacket
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
You know, but John with his felt tip pen. I remember we did the marquee. In fact, I was talking to Nigel the other day. He's doing a book about it. Nigel Hutchins about his time at the marquee. And when we played there, we did the sound check. I went to the loo round the back, come back out, said, "Hey guys, somebody's written a Sex Pistols on the wall." And John went, "Yes, it was me." I said, "Oh, you're not a wall writer, are you?" And he opened his thing and he's got all different coloured felt tip pens.
I do think Sex Pistols, though, is one of the greatest band's names ever. Where did the name come from? Because it's so good.
Basically, by that time, Malcolm Shop was called Sex. And with a pink sign, which IOP made, which was supposed to be like a Rauschenberg's soft sculpture, but we run out of foam padding, so it kind of petered out a little bit. But we were the Pistols from the sex shop, the Sex Pistols. So,
of course,
there you go.
Of course,
Malcolm had a few ideas for some names. One of them was The Damned, which The Damned ended up being called. Guess what? The Damned. You know, we had another band, Creme de la Creme, which was rubbish. Kid Glad Love, which was another thing he came up with. But we liked the Sex Pistols thing, so that was it.
And then, how much influence was there from him with the songs? I mean, with the
None,
yeah.
Not even in the titles or anything. Now,
one song he'd come up, we was rehearsing at the Roundhouse for some reason before we got our own rehearsal place, and it was the crossover period between getting rid of Wally and having our own place. And it was a bit of a schlep. I went with John and Stephen Paul didn't turn up. So me and him went into the pub over the road. And he said, "Are you saying Malcolm?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Anything to say?" And I said, "Not really." I said, "Oh, yeah." He said he had an idea for a song. And John goes, "What is it?" And I said, "Submission." And he went, "What, like bondage and domination or that?" And I went, "Yeah." And he went, "Ugh." And then one of us said to the other, "How about a submarine mission?" So we sat in the pub and traded line each And it was really about taking the mickey out of Malcolm. And then I went home and worked some chords out. And next time we actually did rehearse, we worked it up as a band. That was it. That's how that came about. That's about the only time we actually sat, song we actually sat and co-wrote together.
And what about the lyrics for Anarchy? Was that something that John came up with? Did he understand that sort of stuff? Was that what was going on in his head, or was that Malcolm as well?
There was quite an interesting bunch of people around. There was Malcolm, Vivian, Bernard Rhodes, who was around in the early days, who went on to manage Clash, mm-hmm. and Jamie Reed, who's kind of pretty right on with his politics and stuff.
He did all the artwork, right?
Yeah, but, you know, he'd also been quite an activist kind of thing. Malcolm told me, I don't know how true it is, but like in the early 70s, when credit cards had just come out, and remember, there was MasterCard, there was another one that didn't last. But, you know...
There was another
English one. I forget what it was. I should remember because I got the sack from it. but, you know, I used to have a little, like a credit card, you know, where the corners are slightly rounded off, and they put them in shop windows. You know, this card's accepted here. But he did one, and he got all his mates to go along Oxford Street and put it on the door, like before the shops opened, and it said, looking like a Diners Club card or something else, but it was actually something else saying, this store welcomes shoplifters. And they all went in shoplifting and got stopped. And they said, well, it says on the door, look. Yeah, I don't know whether they were trying to get away with it or whether it was a laugh, how true it was, or whether it was some kind of like, you know, agitprop kind of thing going on.
Save petrol, burn cars is another sticker he used to put around, wasn't it? It was during the oil crisis.
All that kind of stuff. So basically, from sitting around in a pub, I'm sure John picked up some ideas. And
because when I saw you guys play, and I was there, and I've said it before.
where did he see us, and did you paint again?
Screen on the green. I did pay. Well, actually, do you know what? I didn't pay to get in. And I tell you why, because Stephen Woolley was the assistant manager at the Screen on the Green, and he went to our school, and he just
the skinny bloke.
No, he went on to become one of the main producers of Palace Pictures, and he made Mona Lisa The Crying Game was in there. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yes, it is.
Amazing connections, and Roger.
No, that's the bloke I'm thinking
Roger
of.
Was the manager. Anyway, yeah. Steve Woolley worked there, and Steve said to us, you got to come down. The Pistols are playing, Clash, Buzzcocks, come along. That's how I ended up knowing about it. So I think I might have been on the guest list, even though I was 16. And I've listened back recently to the recording of that show because it was such a seminal moment in my life. I mean, literally, Glenn, you changed my life that night because I was in a terrible band before, and I went straight into rehearsals the next day. I went, I'm leaving. And me and Steve Norman, who were at that gig with Steve Dagger, went into school in September and formed what became the band that I was successful with. But it was like an art piece. I remember thinking, now I think about it, it was like an installation. If you listen to the recordings, you play a song. It was amazing. And then there's nothing. There's like a few people like going like this. But the Bromley contingent were at the front taking the piss. And it was the weirdest show I'd ever seen. It was like everyone was being ironic, sarcastic, catty. I mean, in the end, it turned into mad shows with people jumping up and down going crazy. But at the beginning, it was an art piece.
John,
the way he would sneer at the audience and the way they would sneer back at him, the crowd at the beginning.
I think he did that initially because he was probably quite shy, you know, and it was like an act to kind of give him a bit of Dutch courage somehow to hide behind. You know, like Bowie always says that he didn't want to be a singer, he wanted to be an actor, and he portrayed a role. Some of it may be good, some of it's kind of bollocks maybe, but, you know, I think he sort of adopted this persona which kind of stuck. But just going on, you saying that Stephen Woolley be going on to become this and somebody else going, that's what I liked about the punk thing. Nearly everybody who was in that initial coterie of about 25 people all went on to do something of some kind of consequence in their own particular field. The very first gig we played at was St. Martin's, but the very first one I'd actually booked, although it turned out was going to be after that, I wandered into Central School of Art, looking a bit lost in all me rocket, Let It Rock gear when everybody had long hair and greatcoats. And these two guys said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm looking for the social secretary. And the littler one said, well, I am. And then the bigger guy said, no, you're not. I am, and you're my assistant. And they started bickering, right, who was that? And I'm going like, you know, I'm looking for... But those two guys, one was Sebastian Conran, who now or was for a bit was running the Conran Empire, and he was at Central doing ergonomics. The other guy, still a big mate of mine, was Al McDowell. He was in England last year, called me up, said, "What are you doing over here?" He said, "I'm at Pinewood." I said, "What are you doing?" And he was art directing Star Wars 9.
Wow.
He's the first person to book the Sex Pistols, except they didn't do Star Wars 9 because the script was based on Carrie Fisher, who promptly died, and then it was all stuck.
But the real gig, the one that is absolutely mind-blowing, is Manchester, isn't it? Where there was, they said there was 15 people there, but those 15 people were Ian Curtis, Stephen Morrissey, Johnny Marr, Mick Hucknall. I mean, every single person in that audience went on to do something enormous.
Yeah, so I've heard, but I mean, I didn't really know who was who at the time, you know.
Yeah.
But it was funny. That was about 10 years ago. I was playing my all-time favourite band, The Faces, which is kind of funny because the world went full circle because it was a band that got me the gig in the Pistols in the first place. But I still go to a few art school things, and I went to a talk with Kevin Cummins and Paul Morley and some other bloke who was there talking about doing the artwork for the Factory Records things and all that. And then somebody at the end, at the back of the audience, put their hand up, any questions, and said, yeah. They said, who was there at the first Sex Pistols gig? Nobody knew I was there. And they had a little confab on the stage, and the only person they could really agree on, because he went to everything, you know, the opening of an envelope, was Mick Hucknall, who I was actually playing with in the face. It was kind of funny.
I always like, just a story. I was once asked Chris Spelling, because it's always made me laugh, like that when you played the punk festival at the 100 Club, and this is the gig that there's like 50,000 people at least in this country who say they were there, right? Mm. It's like, oh yeah, I saw the Pistols at the 100 Club. And I asked Chris, because of course Chris was on the bill, right, who and he produced your demos, of course, legendary guitarist Chris Spelling. And I said, so Chris, what was it? How many people were actually at the punk festival? And he said, well, when the Pistols went on, probably about 15. When they came off, quite a few less.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
One of the sort of, this isn't a criticism, but one of the pieces of the myth is that, you know, that you guys were put together by Malcolm to sell his clothes. Was there an element of that in it? I mean, you looked amazing. I mean, that was the appeal of the Sex Pistols was the clothes you were wearing. You couldn't buy them anywhere. They were the best looking things I'd ever seen.
Well, no, that's the side of it's true, but he didn't put us together to sell his clothes. We wanted to form a band. We met in his clothes shop, which we went there because we liked the clothes in it. So we kind of took from him. It was a very symbiotic relationship. Mm.
They were very expensive clothes as well.
They were expensive.
It was a designer,
you know.
Shop.
Yeah, it was a designer. Paul always says designer punk, and we were, you know.
But you carried it off. I mean, the pizzazz on stage was always amazing, and you know that, and I always, you know, Johnny doing his sort of mad Uriah Heep kind of thing that he did was extraordinary, and Steve was a guitar hero. In fact, I remember when I saw you that day, and he had Guitar Hero written across his
no
app.
No.
No?
It was Guitar Nero.
Was it? Was it?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
It was Guitar Nero. It looks like Hero from the distance.
Fiddling while Rome burns.
Says Nero, you know.
But you were the tunesmith, though, Glenn. I mean, you were coming up with, you know, listening to that album now. The one thing that stands out is the quality of the songs. You know, this wasn't, a lot of bands came out of the punk movement and thought you just had to play things really super, super fast and sing I Don't Wanna every now and again. But it was a slower sound, and it was, I mean, extraordinary sound from in the production of the guitar, but the tunes, how did that relationship work in the group?
If nobody had done what they did on the records, it wouldn't have sounded like what it sounded like. But there's a demarcation dispute, you know, and I would bring an idea in and we'd knock it around, and then bits would come in, and then you kind of... I used to like getting Steve to play what I was playing on a bass, and once he'd done his bit and got it down, I would try and do something different as a counterpoint kind of thing. But I think my talent in the band was because I liked all those 60s music, you know, songs that kind of hang together as little kind of mini operas. I think I provided a vehicle for John's nutty lyrics, but he didn't write all the lyrics, you know. It's like pretty vacant. That's my song, you know. I wrote that. Submission we co-wrote, 17, Steve's song originally, which John changed around a little bit. But he did write Anarchy in the UK Words, and he did write God Save the Queen, which was originally called No Future, but then it dawned on somebody it was going to tie in with the Queen's Silver Jubilee, so they changed the title, although the words were always exactly the same.
But I'd be interested to know what your melodies were like before John got his hands on them. Because unless you were sort of specifically writing for it, knowing that he was going to do his whole.
Well, I did the Pretty Bacon song, and he did his version of it, kind of thing. But yeah. I would leave the top line thing to him, and then make suggestions when it weren't kind of cutting it. A lot of things we rehearsed in this tiny little room, which was not much bigger than this room.
Oh, it's in Denmark Street, right? You had that place.
Must have been pretty wild as well, because that was another little real microcosm, isn't it? All the guitar shops and all the publishing companies.
Yeah, and there was all people like, who was that guy who did Music Is My First Love?
John Miles.
Yeah, he was always in the guitar shop, possibly. Good luck to him, but hanging out, you know. But it was all people like that, and then there was us, these urchins, you know, and it was...
The legends that have sprung out of that now, because I know that when I was in one of the shops in Denmark Street, I think it's around the back of No Tom that's there now, vintage guitar shop, and I was taken into that rehearsal room, and it was like walking into the Sistine Chapel. There was graffiti on the wall, and we were all wondering, now could that be original? Could Steve or John have done that? You know, and it was.
Well, they are, and I actually saved that for the Nation, because I had the place back again in the early 80s. And I got fed up with that stuff. I wanted to change. So what I did is I wallpapered it over nicely. But you know with that anaglyptus embossed paper you get in pubs that you paint over?
Yeah.
And just papered over the whole thing for a change. And then I went back there about 10 years ago when my kids were littler, because I knew the blokes in the guitar shop, showed them out the back. And there was some, I think Margaret Howell had an office there or something like that. And I said, it's exactly the same. And they said, oh, no, we're going to decorate it soon. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, if you peel the wallpaper off very, very gently, you'll be very surprised. There's all these Johnny Rotten cartoons all over there. Right. No. Anyway, they did it. And that's it. And when they was trying to save Denmark Street, that was one of the reasons that they managed to keep some of the things. It's kind of like grade two listed now.
That's brilliantly forward thinking of you, Glenn. Must have to save it for the Nation.
Well, there you go.
When did you realise?
I'm that kind of guy.
When did you realise you weren't just a band, you were part of the whole movement?
Right before we even picked up an instrument, I think. You know, we was hip. That down at the end of the King's Road, we did a song before it came out. We did Roadrunner by Jonathan Richman and Modern Lovers. Right. But we did it because... Malcolm was mates with Nick Kent, who was mates with the people at Granny Takes a Trip. And one of them used to go in there was John Cowell, who produced the Modern Lovers album. And it hadn't come out yet. And John Cowell had given Nick Kent a cassette with half the album on it, which he gave to Malcolm, which gave to us. The record hadn't even come out. And we thought, what's this song all about? It's so weird. We didn't even realise it was about a car. But it's just had this weird and crazy kind of song. Nobody had heard of Jonathan Richman, and we was doing his song pretty much from the get-go, just because we was in the hippest place at the time.
Steve Jones now says that, or has said, that the two worst things that happened to the Pistols was you leaving and doing the Bill Grundy show. So for anyone who doesn't know, because the Bill Grundy show was so shocking. I mean, Bill Grundy, what time was he on, Guy? I don't even remember. What kind of...
It was 6 o'clock. It was straight after the news, wasn't it?
Yeah, about 6:15 it started.
It was the... You had Nationwide on BBC One, and then you had... was it Thames Today? What was it?
It was
the London local news programme.
Yeah. It was like the One Show, wasn't it, with a grumpy Grundy?
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
They had the Sex Pistols. I mean, what were they thinking? Having the Sex Pistols on that show. Well,
Queen cancelled, wasn't it?
Queen cancelled. Yeah. We got it at the last minute. We nearly didn't do it because we was rehearsing for the Anarchy tour. And in fact, I took a phone call in this place up in Olsen. There was an old cinema there. And Niels, who was working for Malcolm, said, oh, you've got a TV show, we're going to send a limo. And we go, no, we're busy, you know. And I was sort of like, being the band lead, you know, we're busy, we have to rehearse, and we're not doing it. 10 minutes later, there's another phone call. No, we're not doing it. We're in the middle of doing the set. 10 minutes later, Malcolm says, you know, we just signed to EMI. Malcolm says, if you don't do it, you're not getting your wages this week. So we get in the car and we go there and we're there to do this thing. And I've said this before, it's kind of common knowledge, but we get there, we get ushered into the green room. Steve, it's winter, everybody's got coats on. Steve Jones is in and out the green room like Flynn with something under his coat. Me, John, Paul, Malcolm go in there, find those little, you know, remember those 33 centilitre cans of Heineken?
Yeah, yeah.
Or Carlsberg.
Those ones.
But they weren't even half a pint, you know. So we had them. The next thing, we're on the set. What Steve's gone and done, he went in the first, he found a bottle of Blue Nun. He's gone in another room and he's drunk the whole thing himself, right? And then we're on the telly. Halfway through this interview, which is going a little bit tits up anyway, the Blue Nun kicks in and Steve starts swearing his head off. None of it was playing. Behind the cameras, Malcolm's going, oh, no, you've done it now. When we come off after all this, you know, the shenanigans, I went to go back in the green room to see if they'd restocked it. Malcolm, he said, where are you going? I said, I want another drink. He said, no, come on, let's get out of here. Just as well as he did, because as we got in the car, Black Mariah turned up and they all got out with their truncheons to go in. We were sort of waved. They didn't know it was us.
So they sent a Black Mariah because someone said fuck on television. That is amazing. That's the 70s for you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, because even when, was it in the Great Rock and Roll Swindle, in the film, they had to have that blacked out. Even in the early 80s, you still couldn't show that at all. It was completely banned.
Mind you, I think that's where it all started going wrong. We probably wouldn't have had Brexit if Steve hadn't, mate.
What was it like waking up the next morning then to that?
Well, I went out that night and got drunk and I kind of forgot. But I think that night I ended up at Dingle's. I can't remember who it was on. I had a skinful, phones ringing. I had a flat in Chiswick, phones ringing. And Sophie, who was Malcolm's secretary, said, you better come in to Manchester Square. And I said, why? She said, you'll find out. And my head's banging. I'm thinking, and I got the bus. So I was the last one there, because I had to come from Chiswick. And there was a girl I used to see who was quite sort of good looking. And it was one of those things, one day you're going to talk to her. And I think it was Katie Manning, who was a Bond girl at the time. And I was waiting to get on a bus and she gave me such a dirty look. And I thought, what's going on? And as I got on the bus, I'm thinking, it's all starting to come and piece it together in my head. And I thought, And then when I got to Manchester Square, all the other guys were hanging out the window like the Beatles picture. And there's a gauntlet of press photographers there. And I thought, oh, yeah, the Bill Grundy show.
Because it was the Filth and the Fury. It was all over the papers the next day, wasn't it? I mean, that's
I hadn't even seen them at that stage. I hadn't had time to pick up a paper. You know.
In the same way that in the 60s, you know, the Rolling Stones were the bad boys, you'd become the bad boys. And that made every boy want to buy your records, right? It was great.
Yeah, that's so fine.
I don't know why Steve says he thinks it's one of the worst things that happened.
Because it was the beginning of the end. I think John changed after that, as soon as he had his boat race on the front page of all the papers. I thought it was all kind of funny, you know. I was been accused of being, you know, not up for it, but I thought it was the whole thing was funny. But then we did the Anarchy tour, and that became a different matter because we weren't allowed to play anywhere. We still had to turn up in case we could play, and then there was a whole thing to do with, you know, censorship, and it was... You know, the Anarchy tour is supposed to be really exciting, but it's boring, really. You know, we couldn't go out the room or out the hotel and press everywhere. It's just something you're not prepared for. And all the little factions within the band kind of started really coming to the fore. And then for me, it became a different thing. You know, that's when Malcolm came into his fore. The day before the Bill Grundy show, he would have to call up the newspapers or the music press to write about us. And the day after the Bill Grundy show, they were calling him. That was the difference. And then it became Malcolm's baby. And every time there was an interview, instead of an interview with a band, it would be Malcolm talking.
That's right. That's who you saw. That's right.
I got the ump about that. And then we was banned everywhere. And then I go out to see some band, a gig, and a promoter come up to me and go, hey, Glenn, you know, we'll put you on. Tell Malcolm. So I go and tell Malcolm. And he go, no, you're banned. You know, and it kept happening all the time. And there was a dishonesty to it that I didn't think. And I joined a band because I wanted to be a musician.
I want to, sorry, because I think we're kind of running out of time. There's a story that I heard about you, which I've been telling for years, and I will now finally find out whether or not it's true, which is I heard that years ago, you were living in Maida Vale, I think at the time.
Still am.
Okay. Party night at your house, and apparently your Never Mind the Bollocks gold or platinum record fell off the wall,
and the
frame smashed, but the record didn't.
Yeah.
And so you decided to play it to see what it actually was.
Yeah, because...
And apparently it's Tubular Bells.
Hang on. No, because before it fell off the wall, I've been looking at it for years and it didn't look quite right. And it didn't look quite right because there was no bigger gaps between the tracks. So I thought, is my chance? The thing's broken. It didn't break, but it kind of crashed and it slipped out of the bottom of the frame. So I thought, put it on. And yes, it was Tubular Bells.
Yes! You left the band before that album came out. You played on nearly all the album as well, didn't you?
No, I don't play on... Steve plays on a lot, but they're my songs, you know. That's the thing. I don't play...
How many tracks do you play on?
Not that many, but I'm on Anarchy. You know, that's the main kind of thing. I don't like the bass playing on the album.
That's actually the only one that's got any movement in the bass, because Steve just doubles his guitar part, doesn't he?
Exactly. You know. So if you want to hear my bass playing, you should listen to the Spunk tapes. That's my...
Right.
Or the live stuff. You know.
How did it feel for you? And, you know, what caused the breakup? You know, for me, and I'm being it's not because you're here. I never bought the Sex Pistols with Sid. It just seemed like a cartoon. No. But you were the genuine band. And why did you?
I would say this now, but I could see that coming. That was the way it was going, to be like a punk rock Bay City Rollers kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it was just headlines. It was just a big, as soon as Sid was there, it was just about headlines.
And
yeah.
I would say this, but I don't think Malcolm ever understood that we were any good. He really thought we was rubbish. And he thought he was the bloke who was selling London Bridge, you know. But we could play, and I wanted to be in a band to play music.
I like
that side of it. Pardon?
Why did you leave, or... What was the true story behind that?
Well, I've just said, really, it was coming to a head. I didn't like the way it was going. It was no longer a band where everybody had an equal say. And I felt I wasn't being backed up. And I thought they was being daft. Now you say Steve says, you know, getting rid of Glenn was the thing. But I walked, you know, my position became sort of untenable. But if I'd been backed up by Steve and Paul a bit more, it wouldn't have been, but they didn't. They didn't say that. And it's taken all this time for them to realise. So I think we would never have done 10 albums. And can you imagine Johnny Rotten doing the Sex Pistols, but, you know, our Angie. It was never going to happen. But we could have made another 2 or 3 albums, I think. You know.
And what was it like when you got back together?
It was different because we was grown up. We didn't have to sit on the equipment in the back of a Ford Transit with no windows. And we were flying first class between big gigs, not even necessarily on the same flight, not even necessarily on the same day. And we could afford to come to an accommodation with each other. And so we made it work, you know.
That sounds like it wasn't personally a great deal of fun.
It was all right, you know, but that was coupled with doing 3 nights at the Budokan, you know.
Yeah.
And meeting your mates in Tokyo, or going to Santiago in Chile for the first time, or... You know, being the toaster. In fact, one of the best things I remember was we played Roseland Ballroom in New York, did 2 nights there. One night, normally the on-stage mixing desk was on my side of the stage, but for some reason it was on the other side of the stage that night. There was supposed to be nobody on the stage, and they're certainly not on my side because the mixing desk was the other side. And we're doing a couple of numbers, and I thought, there's somebody be behind a PA stack. Now, in the gloom, right, I thought... Nah. So I finished my number and I looked, somebody there. So I went over and there's 2 people there. And you know who it was? Uma Thurman and Dennis Hopper. I thought, yes.
We can't let you go without talking about the Rich Kids.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, Gary, of course, has played with you. But
he's an honorary member, yeah.
I love the Rich Kids. That was so the perfect sound. And why it didn't become the biggest band in the country, I do not know.
It's because Midge and Rusty wanted to wear silly hats and become Gary Neuromantic.
Exactly.
Exactly. That's your fault, Gary.
I wanted to be a rock and roller. You know?
I thought that band was fantastic to look at, visually amazing. Then you started to grow your hair. You got Steve News, this incredible young guitarist who's androgynous looking in his little red beret. I mean, it was all the glam rock sort of traits that I loved.
And Mac from the Faces played.
Yeah, exactly. Which was a connection there. I like when Gary played with us. I thought it was very sweet, and I was quite touched about this. When he was rehearsing, Gary said to me, he said, "Do you know what, Glenn?" He said, "Me doing this must have been what it was like for you playing with the Faces." And I thought, oh, bless you.
It really was. Yeah. It really was.
Oh, he's blushing, look.
It really was. Although, you know, it was a shame we only did we did two shows. We did one for Steve New when he was still, which I jumped up on stage really enjoyed you, just before he died. And then I had the honour of replacing Steve for that one show.
And you could have done the other one we did, but we couldn't get hold of you.
Oh,
and the Lex did it.
Rich Kids, for me, were a kind of... They were the stepping stone, if you like, into the 80s in many ways. I think...
I'm glad you say that. I think we came out a bit before our time. I think we should have waited. You know, and the reason I did the Rich Kids, it would have been very easy for me to form another punk band and be like a second division Sex Pistols or you know, Chelsea or something like that. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something different. That's why I purposely got Midge in the band. Tried out loads of other people first, but I wanted somebody who could sing, you know. And he had a very distinctive voice, great singer. And I kind of wanted to try and put the cat amongst the pigeons. But I remember after that I played with Iggy Pop and we went to Paris. And then we got taken out by the record company to, I think we played at Le Palace in there. And Malcolm McLaren turned up because he was living in Paris at the time and freeloaded a mill. And I didn't really want him around, but you can't really get rid of Malcolm. And Iggy didn't realise I didn't want him there. But Malcolm said to me, he said, "Where you went wrong with the Rich Kids, Buzz?" And this is quite a good point. He said, "It's all very well trying to be looking forward and doing something new in London where punk had been around for quite a while. But when you played out of London, you know, going up north and things like that, kids who were only still just getting into punk thought you was taking away from them what they'd only just discovered." No. And that's kind of quite a good point. I hadn't thought of that. So I think if we'd waited a bit, even Ronson said, you know, he said, you've got a good half an album. And I think it should have been mainly like the first side.
Because Mick Ronson produced you, didn't he?
He did, you know, but what we was listening to between gigs and stuff, we just listened to Low and The Idiot and Heroes and Lust for Life over and over. I should think, apart from Bowie, obviously, we was the first band to ever use a harmonizer on the drum.
And what's this year, what's it been like for you not playing any gigs now, Glenn?
It's what it is, really. You know, I've been doing a few things, been writing. It's a bit frustrating. I made an album, which I finished with Slicks playing on it and a few other people. Just before lockdown, and we were talking to some companies about getting out, but everybody I talked to wants a tour to go with it, and there's no tours to be had just yet. So it's just sitting in abeyance. But now I've been writing, got back to writing. We did a few online things. Slick got stuck here, which was interesting. You know, everybody was doing like online gigs, and we did a few. We was talking about, but of course never got it together because we're like the odd couple, you know.
This is Earl Slick, who used to be Bowie's guitarist. Right?
Yeah, but he's basically like Walter Matthau and I'm the Jack Lemmon. But instead of doing an online gig, my flat needed painting. He offered to help me do it, you know, for his boarding lodging. And I thought it'd be quite funny to put some overalls on. Me and him up the ladder arguing and have a live stream on YouTube about it. But it was like one of those all talked about. I wish we'd done it now. All right, one last question. You're a bit of a punk rocker. You've been a rich kid. Now you're a saucer full of secret. Why have you got a theremin right behind your left ear?
I have got a theremin by me. Woo!
He's a prop head.
I think that's... I might dig that out on the next Sourceful tour. Who knows?
There's a little art gallery opposite, you know, the Soho... what's it, Street Fire Station? You know, the fancy restaurant thing?
Yeah.
Chilton Street Firehouse. Yeah. Opposite there is a little gallery, and I know the bloke. And I went there with Slick maybe 2 years ago, and he has odd kind of outsider art things and all that. But he actually had a recital by the granddaughter of the bloke who invented the theremin.
Wow.
And it was great. And we all had to sit around, and it was round, and we couldn't sit too close. And she made Slick move, because if she got too close within the force field, it would have affected the tuning. So he didn't take too kindly to that, but he sat on the hearth of the fireplace and she ended up, she played some really weird sort of dissonant Russian stuff, and then she played Libro Tango.
I'm more of the sort of Jimmy Page throwing shapes on it, really. I think that's
You know.
Yeah, not learning anything.
Not learning anything. Glenn, thank you for coming on. Thank you.
Brilliant.
Thanks for asking us. Enjoyed it. It's always good talking about yourself. Yeah.
Could have been so much more. The pistols are still the enigma they ever were.
Well, there you go. But there's more where that came from. So maybe another time. But when you're Saucer Full in Secrets, I still haven't seen you because I've always been gigging elsewhere. So let me know if you do get it together.
We absolutely will.
Because I want to hear you guys go. That's my favourite.
We're playing in the UK next. What is it? April?
April. Yeah.
April. And all of this horrible stuff will all be gone. We'll all be vaccinated.
Well, that was Glenn.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, listen, to play in the Pistols is, you know, there aren't many bands. I mean, they are probably, you know, you'd go the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, David Bowie. You would then go the Sex Pistols, wouldn't you? It'd be on that. Your first hand.
Yeah, it's an absolute time stamp.
What a pleasure to talk to him.
Yeah, no, lovely, lovely man. And I do envy you having played with the Rich Kids. I will say that because they were, to me, the perfect sound for that time. I thought that's where everything was going to go.
He said Neil X played in the second gig and I didn't even know that. He said you weren't around, but maybe did I get that message? Oh, dear. Maybe I did.
Scream at your manager.
Anyway, listen, thank you for listening and please subscribe. Thanks for all your reviews and thank you to Ben, our producer. And thank you to ourselves, right? I don't know. Who else do we thank, Guy? I have no idea.
Obviously, our spiritual advisor.
Yes, of course.
And thanks to all of you and thanks to everyone who's keeping the wheels turning in these dark times.
We're back next week with another massive rocker.
Well, you keep your massive rocker to yourself, love. All right, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from all of them.